Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. I denne udgave af Tektopia, der er vi taget på besøg hos Thomas Madsen Mygdal, der er en af mændene bag Techfestival, den årlige Techfestival i København. Og hvis man er fast Tektopia-lytter, så kan man måske huske, at jeg har været her to gange før, fordi Thomas har gang i noget, der ligner en tretrinsraket, der handler om etik i forbindelse med teknologivirksomheder, og hvad det egentlig er, vi vil med vores virksomheder. Du har et stykke papir liggende her, som hedder The Tech Pledge, sådan et løfte, som er kommet i stand i den her tænketank på 150 mennesker, international tænketank, som bliver afviklet hen over et døgn hver eneste år på Techfestivalen. Hvad er det, I har lavet i år?
I år har vi lavet et løfte, et pledge på engelsk, hvad kan man sige. Det løfte, som alle os, der arbejder i den her verden, kan give til, hvad vi aspirerer til, og med hvilke værdier vi skaber, og hvilket ansvar vi har. Nogle mennesker sammenligner det sådan lidt med lægeløftet, at man har sådan en implicit ting, man giver. Det kan man diskutere om den rigtige reference eller ej, men hvad hedder det? Så det vi har prøvet er en verden, hvor det har stukket mange retninger at prøve at samle og faktisk overraskende meget enighed. Selvfølgelig svært at få 150 mennesker til at blive enige om, hvad der skal stå på en E4-side, men retningsmæssigt har det faktisk været meget interessant, at den her erkendelse af, at måske er det flere, det er nok majoriteten af folk, der arbejder i den her verden, der ved det her. Aktivisterne og venturekapitalisterne og iværksætterne og designerne og programmørerne var meget enige. Der var ikke sådan den store friktion på, at folk, der vil samfundet, der vil mere folk, der vil demokratisk kontrol og teknologi. Hvad hedder det? Folk, der fokuserer på det ansvar, vi har og alle de samtaler og diskussioner, der skal tages for at finde de rigtige balancer. Og, så det har været rigtig spændende i år, at det sådan virkelig, der er sket meget de her sidste 24 måneder, fra vi startede.
Men jeg kan ikke engang overskue her, hvor mange punkter der er. Der er lidt over 12 punkter, som man så skriver under på. Ikke? Jeg forpligter mig til, og så de der 12 punkter. Kunne du måske lige, du skal nok ikke læse alle 12 op, fordi man kan jo faktisk læse dem på techpledge.org, men hvad går det sådan i store træk ud på? Hvad er det, man forpligter sig til, når man skriver under?
Man forpligter sig på i sådan 3-4 hovedkategorier at tage ansvar for, at man skaber, at kunne skabe ting, som man vil ønske ens familie og elskede skulle bruge. At tage ansvar og overveje de konsekvenser, både intentionelle og ikke intentionelle. At åbne op for kritik og dialog, og søge dialog, hvis man er usikker på, at det man skaber faktisk tjener ens fællesskab, eller den helhed, man er en del af. Og så kigger vi lidt på, at man pledger at deltage i den demokratiske proces om at regulere teknologi, selvom det er svært, som der står, at kæmpe for demokrati og human rights og de institutioner, der definerer og beskytter dem, at arbejde for, vi er helt oppe i at arbejde for en mere lige, inkluderende og bæredygtig fremtid i reference til Forenede Nationers globale mål. Og så lidt om det her med at hjælpe andre og med at forstå styrken og udfordringerne, som de her digitale teknologier giver, men også at diskutere det. Og så slutter vi af på at snakke lidt om at altid tage vare på det, man starter, og til at fikse det, der vi alle sammen breaker eller bryder. Så det er sådan essensen af nogle af de punkter, der er.
Så lidt et opgør med den der sådan break things, move fast, som Facebook og andre har kørt med, eller fejle forlæns, som man har kørt med i Silicon Valley i mange år. Men det her, det er henvendt til teknologibranchen, simpelthen høj som lav, skal så skrive under på den her og forpligte sig til de her 12 punkter. Hvad nu, hvis de ikke gør det? Altså, det kan godt være, de skriver under, men alligevel så kommer til at gøre et eller andet, som ikke er helt i overensstemmelse. Kommer du så og slår med en stor hammer, eller hvad?
Nej, det er jo aspirerende, det her. Altså, det er jo et løfte, når man, at det handler om, at man, den proces, man selv tænker igennem, når man gør det, man reflekterer over, hvad har man gjort tidligere, Så det, på den måde er det jo, som den her slags løfter er, det er en forpligtelse, det er et løfte for ens fremtid. Det er ikke en mærkningsordning eller en regulering. Det kunne selvfølgelig være noget af det, man kunne lave næste år eller næste år igen, og begynde at tænke på, hvordan kan man certificere virksomhederne for eksempel. Men det vi ser lige nu i teknologiverdenen er jo meget det her med, at det er nedefra og op, at det er også alle sammen os, der arbejder, der også begynder at tage handling. Så det vi meget håber er, at det her en ung programmør designer, der måske ikke er den øverste i hierarkiet, vil også stille os op i et møde og sige, altså jeg har faktisk pledget, at jeg ville stille mig op og gøre det her, hvis der er nogen, der ikke putter mennesker foran forretning, og ens arbejde er defineret forretningsmodellen, og ikke er, hvad der rigtig er den rigtige produkt eller den rigtige tjeneste for de brugere. Så på den måde er det sådan lidt at give sådan lidt handlekraft til dem, og også at jeg for eksempel som direktør og leder i en virksomhed kan skrive under, og så derved har jeg jo også sendt signalet til medarbejderne, jeg forventer også det af dem, at så der på den måde kan der også være lederskab i det. Så på den måde er det jo ikke, du ved, der det klassiske journalistiske spørgsmål, betyder det noget? Og det kan vi jo se, det gør, at det har inspireret bredet det første år, og så videre en masse forskellige ting, der begynder at ske. Men primært jo en erkendelse, en holdningsændring. Og så mange ting der er sådan lidt, hvad kan man sige, nogen vil sige, ja, det er jo ret oplagt det her, det er jo det samfund, vi er en del af. Men problemet er jo, at vi har haft, som du var inde på, at vi har haft den her propaganda, vi har været enormt defineret Silicon Valley, 100-200.000 mennesker i en provinsby meget langt væk herfra. Deres hele den digitale epoke her de første 25 år, og hele startup-bølgen har også været meget defineret på deres modeller. De har slet ikke været gentænkt i en europæisk, skandinavisk eller dansk sammenhæng. Så det er jo også, på den måde er det jo, hvad kan man sige, lidt, nogle ting er sådan lidt åbenlyst, men det er for, jeg tror også, det er vigtigt at skabe den der enighed i teknologiverdenen, at det er faktisk det, vi baserer vores tro på, og ikke på noget andet. Og det er også, synes jeg, det vi ser lige nu, at det går op for folk, at det er nok det her, der er majoriteten. Og som jeg sagde, at det var faktisk lidt, der var nogle af dem, de meget aktivistiske deltagere, der nærmest bagefter var lidt chokeret over, at hvor enige de faktisk var med venturekapitalisterne og folk, der havde bygget meget store virksomheder, og folk, der havde bygget globale open source projekter osv., at fordi hvis du har en europæisk eller et progressivt amerikansk fundament, så kan det jo ikke være nogen vild idé, at man skal regulere tingene, sådan så det er demokratisk baseret, de beslutninger, vi tager for hvilken verden, vi gerne vil leve i.
Og nu snakker vi gennemslagskraft. Du nævnte selv før, det startede for 2 år siden med The Copenhagen Letter, som var sådan en A4-ark, hvor man hvad skal man sige, lavede en hensigtserklæring om, hvor man skulle bevæge sig hen med teknologi, og hvad problemstillingen egentlig var. Og sidste år, så var det så sådan en session, hvor man lavede en masse plakater, der blev samlet i en bog, Københavner-kataloget. Og der ved jeg, du har rejst rundt med, altså hvad har du fået af respons på The Copenhagen Catalog, som den hedder, du har den liggende der foran dig?
Ja, hvad responsen var? Jeg tror, der er rigtig mange ting, der har inspireret folk. Altså, kataloget sidste år var jo 150 mennesker, der lavede en plakat hver med et princip for den digitale verden. Hvad hedder det? Jeg tror, et brevet det første år var mere sådan et, det var sådan et virkelig nødråb fra at sende et nyt signal. Det var en meget hård proces. Folk, der nærmest gik depressivt ned, fordi de var i gang med at evaluere de sidste 15-20 år af deres liv, og hvad de havde troet på, og hvad de havde arbejdet for, og folk, der havde arbejdet hos Facebook og Google inde i kernen af maskinen, og folk, der havde været blevet sat til at growth hacke og fokusere på de forkerte ting, og i stedet for faktisk at bygge gode produkter og tjenester. Så der har været en enorm respons rundt omkring i verden. Det resonerede meget ude i verden, og vi er jo fantastisk være et sted, hvor med tech-ambassadøren og Vestager og de her ting, at folk ligesom, du ved, snakker om, at Danmark er dem, der leder Europa, selvom vi er nogle af de mindste fisk, der findes. Så det har været inspirerende. Og så synes jeg, vi ser det, altså det er jo stadig meget sådan en mindsetting, at folk printer plakaterne ud, hænger dem op på designskoler og diskuterer dem i ledelsesworkshops, hvilke principper, der er interessante, hvilke ting, der applicerer dem. Så det er blevet sådan et værktøj på en måde. Men det jeg tror, jeg personligt er allergladest for, er jo sådan nogle ting som, at Canon for eksempel har en af deres store forretningsenheder, Milestone har lavet en København, The Copenhagen Clause, i deres kundebetingelser, hvor de nu siger, at de kun vil tillade, at deres software bliver brugt til lovlige formål og efter FN-standarder, og har opsagt partnerskabet med, med en af deres største kinesiske partnere, fordi at deres kameraer nok blev, de kinesiske kameraer og deres software nok blev brugt i nogle situationer i Kina, der ikke lige overholdt menneskerettighederne, arbejdslejre osv., eller hvad det nu var, jeg ved ikke, hvad det specifikt var, men det var i hvert fald ikke det rigtige. Og det er jo fantastisk, du ved, når vi ligesom sidder her i lille København og bringer mennesker sammen for hele verden til at prøve at skabe noget output og noget impact, at altså nogle af Japans største virksomheder med nærmest Japan-Kina ideologiske forskel og så videre. Så det er meget inspirerende det her, det er faktisk, altså folk bliver ved med det her med etik og ansvar, det bliver sådan lidt nogle bløde ting, som sådan lidt icing on the cake, men i virkeligheden er det jo ekstremt fundamentalt, hvad er det for nogle produkter, man bygger, hvordan bygger man dem, til hvilket formål bygger man dem, hvilke værdier og perspektiver designer man ind i dem, og hvad er det, man vil tillade ens skabninger bliver brugt til. Og på den måde er det er jo sådan virkelig kerne, det er jo ikke sådan en lille 1%, vi ender helt ind og snakker i kernen, og det er enormt spændende.
Den her tech pledge, det her løfte, hvis man gerne vil skrive under på det, hvordan finder man det, hvad gør man?
Man kan på techpledge.org kan man skrive under digitalt og downloade pdf'er og med videre, og allerede her efter et par dage her er der mere end 1000, der har gjort det, og det begynder at sprede sig, folk der siger, jamen jeg tager det ind i morgen og underviser mine 100 studerende i Holland og printer det ud til dem og så videre, folk der har stået på scener allerede rundt omkring og prøvet at få hele publikum til at skrive under og så videre, mens på telefonen mens de var der og så videre, så det begynder allerede. Det er jo det fantastiske ved, at det faktisk er 150 mennesker, der har skabt det her. Jeg føler, at et enormt ejerskab har været igennem en proces med det. Det er virkelig en kollektiv skabelse. Det havde været ret nemt at skrive det her på forhånd, og så lavet som om, at det var noget, vi gjorde. Men det er altid en virkelig hård proces, det her. At få folk til at blive enige og skabe retning. Og netop når man skal få 150 mennesker til at blive enige om et stykke af 4-4, så er det lidt sjovt. Så der allerede der sker der en masse, så vi håber jo, at folk vil være med til at hjælpe og sprede det, bruge deres virksomhed og diskutere det, printe det ud, tage det med ned til frokost, eller sige til chefen, skulle vi ikke alle sammen skrive under på det her? Og så tror jeg, at vi på et tidspunkt kommer til at kigge på, om der kan være en version, som virksomhederne også skal skrive under, ikke? Så det er ligesom virksomheden, der forpligter sig, hvor pledget her er et individuelt løfte, fordi vi ser det som det, der sker lige nu i teknologien, er den her individuelle bevægelse, Google, arbejdsnedlæggelser, hvor 20.000 medarbejdere nedlægger arbejdet osv. Altså, der virkelig er nogle, der er nogle store dynamikker i spil lige nu. Men det er klart, at det kan være, at man skal lave en virksomhedsudgave eller nogle andre værktøjer på et tidspunkt baseret på det.
Og alt det her, det skete jo på Techfestivalen. De 150 mennesker mødtes og lavede det her sådan løfte. Der talte jeg også med en, der hedder Sarah Drinkwater, som arbejder for en investeringsfond, som vi står og arbejder sammen med. Jeg kunne lige måske præsentere en for mig. Hvem er hun?
Sarah Drinkwater er ansvarlig for hele det her good tech, responsible tech hos Omidyar Network, som er en fond, der originalt er stiftet af eBay-stifteren Pierre Omidyar, som arbejder meget progressivt både med kommercielle investeringer, men også med, hvad kan man sige, impact-investeringer, så vi er så heldige, at de faktisk har været i år med til at støtte arbejdet med Tænketanken som vores globale partner, hvilket er fantastisk. De har f.eks. også virkelig støttet nogle af de her grupper, der har hjulpet de folk, der lavede Google Walkout osv., og støttet dem, givet dem juridisk hjælp osv., hele det her bottom-up paradigmeskift i teknologiverdenen med arbejderne, der begynder at tage ansvar, medarbejderne, der begynder at tage ansvar. Så de arbejder meget aktivistisk, kan man sige, og meget innovativt i forhold til, hvordan man skaber forandring i verden.
Godt, lad os høre, hvad Sarah Drinkwater, hun sagde til mig, det var i en hotellobby. Jeg skal beklage lige i starten, der er der altså en, der har taget et meget skrigende barn med, som sidder over sofaen bagved os, men de forsvinder.
So we were founded by Pierre and Pam Omidyar in 2004 off this old eBay, and we are a venture fund that strongly believes that tech can and should be a force for good. We do for-profit investments, non-profit investments, but more importantly, a lot of work around kind of community building and advocacy. In the past, that's meant work in education, financial inclusion, independent media, but increasingly in the last few years, it's become clear to us that one of the most pressing issues of our time is around resetting the future path of technology. The dominance of the major platforms, the misinformation landscape, the attention economy, these are all pressing issues that are reducing our ability to think and do better. So the work that I do is work to fund experimental efforts to rethink that course. I work to, and alongside, influence founders, entrepreneurs, product managers, engineers to build better, to create stronger ethical guidelines for themselves, to put nudges into their products that help them treat their users with respect.
So it's both about products and about the companies, how they're organized and their business plans and so on. Could you give us some examples, concrete examples of your work?
Of course. And I think you make a really good point. We always point to problems with products, but to me, these go back to culture and process. You know, you look at a company like Uber, which has undeniable utility, but the culture of the company itself has influenced so many of the product decisions they've made. And I think it's undeniable that how a company gets started, whether it's the board, whether it's the business model or the articles of association, this is how we influence the products that we build. So, for example, we're really interested in, and this is something your engineering listeners may be interested in. So I used to work in Google Maps, and often when we were building a product feature, we had a very set technical process for how we would ideate new ideas. And at no point did anyone say in that process, what does this mean for the user? Are we consequence scanning? Are we looking at all the things that could go wrong? Are we looking at bad actors and how they could misuse this piece of tech? So last year, we co-created Ethical OS, and it is basically a product framework that product teams can use really early on to insert into their regular process to ask the right questions. And part of the reason that we co-created this is we weren't looking for something to fund and we couldn't find something. This was a year and a half ago. Even then, the scene was very different. It's been used by, it was used by 50 companies on the first day, from kind of Google X to SAP to lots of tech startups. And we're now making a version two. So that's kind of one very tactical example. I'm also announcing today a really exciting new investment for us. I think one thing that has been happening in the last couple of years is this ongoing narrative of techlash, this ongoing narrative around the many harms. And that's important. It's important that we as citizens understand what's happening with our data, what's happening with these large companies. But I know myself, and I look at my friends who are builders, they want to build something. They want to kind of move towards a vision of the future. And an organization that's done this very well is called the Zebras Movement. They are a community of entrepreneurs that came out of Seattle on the west coast of America that have scaled a community of entrepreneurs in kind of Edinburgh and Portugal, all around the world, from kind of Nairobi to Austin. And their notion is that they are zebras, not unicorns. Zebras are real, unicorns aren't. Zebras make money and do good at the same time. They are cooperative, they are sustainable. They're trying to be good citizens. And we're really excited to announce today that we're funding them to kind of scale their organization. You know, they built this chapter model around the world of entrepreneurs who are trying to build ethically. And we're really interested to understand what does it mean to power the organization to do more. So a lot of the work we do is very experimental in that we tend to invest early on. We have a couple of really interesting things coming up that are investments, for-profit investments in what we believe to be good tech. But all of these things are tests. It's too early to know what will succeed. And that's why we're taking the approach of being very very tactical and very experimental of, you know, how do we influence change in companies that have been going for 20 years? We don't know the answers yet, but we think we have to start somewhere.
But if you look at the tech industry and the way it has developed for the past, like, at least 10, 20 years with the World Wide Web, it's all based on this freemium business model. I mean, isn't it the freemium business model that you would actually have to change? And is it really possible to change something that is so deeply rooted in the way that these companies make their money?
Yeah, I think you ask a really good question. If I point to, you know, for me, the business model is an inherent part of the problem. You know, if we think about cultures, if we think about the start of any company, how you make money, you know, there were all these companies that were allowed to grow quite big in terms of their scale because they were selling our data, because they were ultimately building mass audiences without thinking about how they made money. We're in a very different moment now. You know, you look at particularly B2C companies in Europe, and it's quite rare to find a scalable B2C company. I think Spotify is an interesting example because they found a model that works. They found subscription. And I think what we have to do is, first of all, shift our mindset as users. Like, ultimately, if we're not paying for something, we're what's being sold. At the same time, I'm personally a massive believer as an ex-journalist. You know, I pay for my Guardian, I pay for my FT. I think you have to you have to. It's a little bit like the union model, right? To be part of a broad, to be part of a larger movement, you have to pay. And that's why a couple of the investments that we will be announcing soon, that I'm afraid I can't talk about yet, are exploring new models of how to make money. Because ultimately, any business has to make money, of course. I'm not at all, you know, I think that's an essential part of any company. But what I'm interested in is, as a founder starting out, how do you experiment with these models early on? How do you get investment that will help you make these experiments? Because, you know, I've seen so many European companies, and I do think Europe has a very different ethos to this compared to America to start with, and to me that's quite interesting. I've seen so many great European companies start and test and fail, partly because I think in Europe we're not as accustomed to testing, learning and failing in the way that American firms are. I think there's more Europe could do there.
Could you elaborate a bit on the difference between unicorns and zebras? Because, yes. I mean, as a listener, you might not be familiar with these expressions. I mean, what is a unicorn?
Yes.
What is a zebra? What is the difference? And how do they actually function?
Thank you, Henrik. That's a very good point. I should have done that. So a unicorn is a commonly used phrase to denote a startup with a market cap of over $1 billion. And I don't know if your listeners will have been following, for example, WeWork is the unicorn's unicorn, I would say. On one level, it's a very basic company. It offers office space. At another level, it's IPOing very soon. It has a very high valuation. And I would argue a lot of what it's being valued so highly for, it does not own any concrete assets. Most of its physical space is rented rather than owned. So there's a lot of debate around unicorns. Are they real? Are they a myth? Are we part of a bubble? You know, it's become a bit of a milestone for certain entrepreneurs to become a unicorn because they're focusing on making money over everything else. With the zebras, and there's a fantastic blog post that the four founders wrote that I would really advise your listeners to it's called Zebras Fix What Unicorns Break, and I would really recommend it. It's a great outline of what this community means. To be a zebra, it's an identity. It's to be an entrepreneur that wants to make money and do good within your society, and that's defined broadly. It could be your local city, it could be the scene that you work in, it could be global if your ambition is that high. You're aiming for 2x returns versus 10x returns, you know, a reasonable return. You might be less keen to take venture capital money for that reason, because venture capital often has outsized expectations. And I think what's interesting about the zebras is they, because the founders are themselves, they have four startups, they each have their own startup. They articulated what they felt personally, that they felt the existing startup scene did not speak to them. They felt like the Silicon Valley scene did not speak to them. And that's why they decided to band together and talk openly about this identity and found that it resonated with entrepreneurs across the world. You know, and so they found that their community spontaneously began starting up these zebra chapters. So for example, in London, there must have been 3 or 4 now. And interestingly, there are certain commonalities amongst these groups. Very often the founders are women and minorities. Very often they don't take classic VC money. You know, very often they want to either bootstrap, where you fund yourself, or they want to make revenue early. You know, they often want to build companies that are sustainable rather than hypergrowth and then fail, hypergrowth and then sell. And to me, if I think about a commonality many ethical founders have, and I'm thinking of companies here like Glitch and Basecamp and Buffer, who are all American firms who have grown very thoughtfully, a lot of the time it's about speed. You know, if you think of the Move Fast and Break Things movement, that phrase that Facebook used, I think a lot of the challenges we've seen have been because, you know, certainly in my experience, people are very keen to launch things out the door. You know, within many tech firms, you're still rewarded for launching new things. You're not rewarded for bug fixing. You're not rewarded for maintenance. You get promoted or you get status from launching things. Whereas I want to argue for stewardship, for maintenance, for thought, for care. You know, I think this is how we get to better technologies and also kind of giving ourselves deeper meaning. It's one thing to launch a product and not know what happens to it, but it's another to really work on making something fit for its users, making something right for its users, and that's what I'm really excited by.
What do people in Silicon Valley think about this? Are they listening to what you're saying, or is it mainly people outside of Silicon Valley who are building zebras?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. So I obviously am a Londoner, or like I'm British, but I'm also from London, and I've been working a lot in Silicon Valley for the last 10 years. I was at Google for a long time. And when I left Google about 18 months ago for Omidyar Network and this team, many friends who work in technology companies from Berlin to Tel Aviv to San Francisco were like, what is this? At the time, it felt like an uphill battle. I think since then, the tide has massively turned. You know, you've had these milestone moments like Zuckerberg in front of Congress, like the Google walkouts. You know, you've had these very big signals that as consumers, the tide is turning. You know, you have the next election in the US. Nearly every candidate is talking about big tech regulation. And what's really exciting to me is there is this wave, not all of them, I want to be clear, not all of them, I wish it was all of them. You have this wave of people who are thinking differently, even in the Valley. I think what's difficult is the market incentives. You know, we talk a lot to many VC firms, and what we're hearing from VC firms in New York and Silicon Valley and in London and Berlin is they're really interested in how they can be helping their portfolio companies, how they can be using the boards they're on and the diligence processes to help companies be thoughtful about these problems. But then, of course, they have their LPs to answer to. So it's a little bit like an octopus, and there are multiple ways in, and we have to work out, you know, there is no common definition of what good looks like. This is a challenge. All we can do is test. We have to work out how we, I think it's happening, but slowly, how we accelerate this movement that I believe will and must happen. But I think what's interesting is a lot of the leaders of this movement are not based in Silicon Valley, to your point. And to me, it's very notable that, you know, you see classic Silicon Valley conferences like Code, Kara Swisher's Code. You know, this year they had an ethics track for the first time. And then you come to Copenhagen and there's a 10,000 person festival fully focused around this topic. And the word ethics isn't used because to me that can be a little bit remote and a bit philosophical. But this conference is all about practically, you know, beyond conversation, what do we build? What do we do? And to me, that's very exciting. And it speaks to the fact that this conversation has been live in Europe for a long time. And that the Valley really ought to pay more attention to what's happening outside of under its own nose, I think.
So when you talk about sustainability, it could be both on the business side, but it could also be all the way down to specific products. Mm. Do you have any examples of that?
Yeah, I think... So, for example, there's a really great VC called Earnest Capital, and they use a very unusual capital tool to deploy money. Their theory is that there are many companies out there that do not want to enter into the classic venture capital conversation, but they want a little bit like a bank loan. You know, they want to borrow a certain amount of money to help the company keep going. And often these are companies that have begun as side projects that have gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger. But for the founders to make that leap to work on it full time, they often require a very small cash injection. So this particular firm uses, it's called a seal agreement. And what it means is the founder, it's a little bit like a loan that's capped against the founder's salary. You know, when I think about sustainability, it's partly about, you know, can the founder and their team pay their bills? Can they hire people and give them the assurance that it will be a job that they can have some security against? And having worked for a couple of startups that have folded very quickly, that's not the case with every startup. But beyond that, there's other dimensions to think about as well. You know, particularly, I'm really interested in the conversation around climate and technology. You know, we forget that to mine Bitcoin, you know, it uses a huge amount of energy. You know, it's pretty unethical, I would argue. So for me, there are many dimensions to kind of building a sustainable, ethical tech company. And, you know, there are many pitfalls for founders, and that's why I welcome conversations like Tech Festival, but also, you know, the founder communities that most hubs in Europe have, the founders get together and talk about these problems, because it's very hard, I think. And that's where I think we as funders can help provide that space, provide those support mechanisms. You know, we had a retreat in February for 140 leaders, from VPs at classic big tech firms to entrepreneurs to policymakers. And the goal of that 2 days was really to have a safe space to talk about what they've been testing out, to have space to be wrong. I think we're in a moment where people realize how important this problem is, of the harms technology can bring, but there often isn't that permission to kind of get things wrong. We're very hard on ourselves, I think. So for me, it's important that we have these private spaces for entrepreneurs to kind of share their problems and work out what the right solutions could be, without that fear of, will I get this wrong first time if I try something out?
And so on. But did you have any examples of companies building products that are some sort of more like zebra-like or?
Yeah, I think there's a company in New York called Canopy that's really interesting. So their founder built Spotify's Discover Weekly algorithm. And what they do is they use differential privacy. This is a very new kind of technology where you insert noise into the algorithm, which means that, you know, normally the way recommendations work is they hoover up your data and they know Sarah, who's in her late 30s in Copenhagen, is listening to this one band. The way differential privacy works is it would say a woman in her late 30s, it anonymizes it at scale. So how their product works, and I was just emailing the founder, so I've just been thinking about this. The way their product works is your data is stored locally on the CPU. So what that means is advertisers get a sort of an aggregated suggestion of what a woman at this age, a woman of this age is using and looking at. And what it means is I get the same quality recommendations that another platform would give me, while also knowing my data is safe. I think what's interesting about that model is we are so used as consumers to absolute convenience and absolute personalization. And we have to go on this journey, you know, if we want to, you know, I think there's a growing awareness of large companies using our data. At the same time, we're almost not willing to give up the convenience. So we have to think about the trade-offs here. And I'm not saying, you know, what I'm understanding about differential privacy is it allows for very good personalization in a way that respects privacy. But I think we'll see an awful lot more companies like that coming up in the next year where they are reinventing the models that we perhaps have got used to. So for example, you know, I can't think of many. If I think about the young people that I know, people under 20, very few of them use the social media that you and I might do. You know, they don't use Facebook, they don't use Twitter, they don't use Instagram. They're far more interested in very ephemeral, like TikTok, that kind of thing, which I'm far too old for. Or they don't use social media at all. And, you know, I think Tiny Beans is one quite good example here. So I became a mum recently. And then you have to think about your children's privacy. And to me, that's really, I just had never considered that I'm now responsible for a small person who, you know, I like Facebook and social media came out when I was in my late 20s. So I'm very grateful it wasn't around when I was a student. It was very different then. Whereas, you know, now from the beginning of a child's life, you have to decide, is their face public property? What does it mean? You have apps like Zhao and FaceApp in the last month that are viral sensations, but there is no clarity around their data privacy policy. So lots of parents I know are using an app called Tiny Beans. It's an Australian company that's headquartered in New York. And what it does is it allows very highly selective showing of photographs. So for example, I can have an app with folders of my son on that only my mum and my husband's mum can access. And they have highly private servers. They have a very strict security policy. And I think, and that's a paid for service. And I think what's interesting is they've been able to capture a very particular niche that really cares about this topic. So what I want to see is, whether it's Tiny Beans or Canopy, what are the versions of that that are rethinking Facebook? What are the versions of that that are rethinking Google? And I don't think we have those yet, but I think they will come in time, I hope.
But did I understand it correctly that Omnijar also invests directly in companies?
Yes, we do for profit investing too.
So if you do investing, could one say that your capital is sort of patient because you have to wait longer to get your investment, return on your investment?
That's true. And I think also we're unusual and very fortunate in that we invest in for-profit and non-profit. So we care about more than the financial returns. It very much is about, you know, I believe that certain things do take time. You know, with any investment firm, you need like an 8 to 10 year life cycle to understand what will be successful. And I think one thing that's very interesting about data privacy as one example is, you know, many investors are cautious about that area because they see how successful apps that harvest our data are. You know, you only have to look at like a Zhao that went viral last weekend. They're very successful. At the same time, we have a very strong core belief that privacy tech as a field, that the average user, that the average user on the street will begin to care more about this, and that's why we want to invest now. And like I said, we have some investments coming that I just can't talk about yet, I'm afraid, because they're not confirmed.
Okay. If you're a user and you want to use a service from a zebra company, where do you go to sort of get an overview or to find these companies?
Okay, great question, because we're funding the zebras to do exactly this. So we're funding them to essentially enable better discovery, to census their community and help the average person on the street find zebra companies for exactly this reason. And I think what's exciting is, I'm very excited about this investment in many ways, but for me, there's something about the identity piece that's very powerful. If I think about my developer friends, 5 years ago, they all became agile. You know, there are, you know, a lot of the movement now around Techlash feels like it doesn't belong to technologists. It feels like it belongs to the average person on the street who's angry. And for me, being a passionate optimist and a technologist, it's really important that we build better. And to build better, we need to have something we're going towards. So for me, the Zebra Movement is all about articulating a way of being that just feels right. It feels right for this moment. And I'm really excited to kind of bring this idea to more audiences. I think what would be a shame is if you look at what's happening politically now in the UK, in the US, and I'm just drawing very broad conclusions. As a British person right now in the UK, things are so complicated that it's tempting to disengage. It's tempting to say, I cannot follow this endless Brexit news. I will not read the newspaper. That would be so wrong. It's my duty as a citizen who cares about the future of my country to engage. It's my duty to work out how we as a country move forwards. And I feel exactly the same as the technologists. I think it's our duty to work out how we build better. It's, you know, I think as a user, I want products that bring me all of the beauty of the internet, the knowledge, the connection, the utility, but in a way that respects my rights as an individual. And I passionately and firmly believe that we can get there, but it takes intent, and it takes thought, and it takes time. And that's what citizens ought to be advocating for, is those things, their own rights.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thomas Madsen Mygdal, det var så Drinkwater fra, og jeg kan simpelthen ikke udtale det, Omidyar, ja, var det rigtigt?
Omidyar Network.
Omidyar Network, som vi hørte her, som talte meget om, hvad skal man sige, at drive ordentlig forretning i tech-branchen. Hun talte også om forskellen på en unicorn og en zebra, og hun forklarede det sådan, som en unicorn, det er jo sådan en virksomhed, som har over 1000 ansatte og har en markedsværdi på over 1 milliard dollars, hvor en zebra er noget mere sådan, hvad skal man sige, bæredygtig på en eller anden måde, måske ikke har så mange ansatte, måske ikke har den der markedsværdi, men tilfører en anden værdi til samfundet. Hvad tænker du, har vi nogen zebra i Danmark? Hvordan ser det egentlig ud på zebra-markedet?
Ja, altså det er jo, zebra-fænomenet er jo sådan en italesættelse af virksomheder, der bliver bygget på nogle andre værdier end vækst for vækstens skyld, kan man sige, som meget har været paradigmet med Uber og alle de her virksomheder, og med alle de problemer, de har skabt, overtrædet lovgivningen, frygtelige arbejdspladser, sexual harassment, nærmest hele MeToo-bølgen startede nærmest også med Uber og nogle af de ting, der foregik der. Så det er jo en anden bølge, vi havde de to stifter fra The Zebra Movement her. Så det vi er jo i gang med er den her bevægelse til at se, at der kan være flere måder at bygge virksomheder på. Det er ikke enten eller, men der er flere måder, og det er okay. Hvor vi de sidste 10 år har set den her jagt i startup-verdenen, og også kvæg venturekapitalisternes incitamenter og logik handler om, at de skal ramme en, der bliver kæmpestor, og så er det egentlig ligegyldigt, at alt det andet, de har investeret i, ikke rigtig bliver til noget, hvis de bare kan ramme den der ene. Så det er den der guldgraveri, kaliforniske guldgravementalitet, hvor man er ligeglad med alle. Eller rent logisk set er det lige, hvis de investerer 100 virksomheder, skal der bare komme en af dem, så er alt godt. De andre 90, er man ikke nødvendigvis nogen økonomisk incitiveret til at sørge for at blive en god og stabil virksomhed.
Uagtet, at der faktisk skal være nogle rigtig gode idéer, nogle rigtig gode virksomheder og dygtige mennesker i det felt, som så bare ikke bliver sådan noget, fordi de ikke kan ramme det der sådan, punkt, hvor de har så stor en markedsværdi.
Ja, og hele tiden, altså du har jo det her sådan, det der hedder en pivot af skifte retning, altså hvis det ikke vokser hurtigt nok, så skal vi lave noget andet. Hvor man kan sige, det andet udgangspunkt normalt jo måske er, hvad man bygger, hvad man er interesseret i, passioneret for. Vi sidder her i min virksomhed 23, hvor vi har været i gang i snart 15 år, og i virkeligheden længere end det med photosharing og det her paradigmskift fra tekstuel til visuel kommunikation og video, som altså det er jo ikke, vi kommer ikke til at bare, vi kan vokse over det, hvis lige pludselig bliver en taxaservice, altså det er vores passion, det er noget, vi har bygget på i meget lang tid, og så på den måde det er jo i virkeligheden også et mere europæisk udgangspunkt, det er derfor, vi har valgt at highlight det rigtig meget i år til Tech Festival, også at alle de mindre og mellemstore virksomheder i Danmark, i Tyskland har du det, man kalder det Mittelstand, alle de her sådan 200-500 mands virksomheder, som ligger i Tyskland, som i virkeligheden er en kæmpe stor del af økonomien og globale ledere inden for alle mulige meget små nischer. Hvad hedder det? Så det er igen en del af for os det her, er der en europæisk model, er der en nordisk model, er der en dansk model, der er anderledes? Og ja, der tror jeg, vi har lært en generation af iværksættere at køre på en meget endimensionel model, som jo heller ikke rigtig er sådan, man har bygget de store virksomheder historisk i Danmark før. Lego, Grundfos, Danfoss, dem der blev stiftet i kældre fra 60 år siden, de har vokset stille og roligt, har meget langsigtet ejerskab. Så vi er virkelig ved at starte sådan en ny samtale omkring, hvad er det for nogle forskellige typer, og det vigtigste også bare, det er okay. Altså, at hvis du har en virksomhed med 50 medarbejdere, så skaber du nok flere arbejdspladser end de store teknologigiganter gør i Danmark, og du betaler nok også mere skat, end de gør, og så videre. Så i faktisk i virkeligheden kan være en 50-100 mands virksomhed være en bedre ting for vores samfund, end en startup, der bliver solgt for en masse penge, men så forsvinder jobsene igen, eller en amerikansk virksomhed, der kommer ind udefra, som ikke rigtig er en del af samfundet på samme måde, eller en udenlandsk virksomhed. Så det er en super spændende tid, det her med at gøre det okay, at putte sine værdier ind i den virksomhed, man bygger, og også meget det her mere langsigtede perspektiv, relationelle perspektiv, bæredygtige perspektiv, kontra den sådan vækst for vækstens skyld.
Hvis vi lige skal runde din tretrinsraket af her med The Copenhagen Letter, The Copenhagen Catalog og The Tech Pledge her, hvad kommer der så til at ske i 2020 på Tech Festival? Hvad bliver det næste skridt i den her udvikling?
Det er et godt spørgsmål. Vi, i forhold til sådan, hvad tænketanken skal arbejde på, er der faktisk flere, der havde mange gode idéer her under tænketanken. Skal vi kigge på de her kundekontrakter, man har, de her 70 sider, man siger OK til, uden at læse dem? Er der et nyt paradigme der på at gøre noget andet, som man kunne skabe? Lidt også inspireret af den her Copenhagen Clause fra Canon og Milestone. Der er andre idéer til, hvad det er, der kunne være vigtigt at arbejde på. Vi kommer til at fortsætte med at prøve at gøre Tech Festival til det globale mødespunkt for den her nye bevægelse og de nye aktører. Hvad enten det er, hvordan vi integrerer i samfundet og bruger teknologikompetencerne der, eller hvordan vi bygger morgendagens virksomheder, som hele det her Zebra, andre måder at bygge virksomheder på, eller den europæiske model, hele det her sådan opgør med at være indoktrineret af nogle andres værdier og perspektiver, ikke fordi de er forkerte, men bare fordi at vi skal finde en balance. Så vi kommer til at fortsætte det, og så må vi se, hvad vi kommer til. Nu er vi jo lige færdige, så nu er vi i gang med at lukke ned for det her år og begynde at kigge på næste år. Men det er enormt givende, og det er enormt spændende at mærke den energi, der er i det, og det virkelig er sådan en menneskelig bevægelse. Det føles enormt meningsfuldt at få lov til at gøre det her. Og vi håber, vi kan få lov til at blive ved med at gøre det, og vi ser en kæmpe mulighed også for at vi kan skabe det teknologivendt i verden, hvor den her samtale og de her løsninger og de her mennesker mødes.
Thomas Mads Mygdal, tak til dig, fordi du igen ville fortælle lidt om, hvad I går rundt og laver i Tænketanken på Tech Festivalen. Og tak fordi jeg måtte besøge dig i din Zebra.
Det var en fornøjelse. Tak.
Det var Thomas Mads Mygdal, der er en af initiativtagerne til Tech Festivalen og til Tænketanken med de 150 medlemmer, som jeg var ude og interviewe her. The Tech Pledge, altså det her teknologiløfte, han har været med til at lave i Tænketanken, ja, det linker jeg til på techtopia.dk, og så kan du gå ind og kigge på det og overveje, om du skal skrive under på det og begynde at leve op til det. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.